Thank you, President Thomas, for a wonderful and moving introduction. Thank you. I will be a little controversial, pretty brief, but I will not sing. I want to thank the President and Mrs. Thomas and the members of the Conference Planning Committee and my brother from another mother, Dexter Gordon, our honored speakers, our community partners, fellow panelists and presenters, brothers and sisters in struggle, thank you. I am humbled and honored to have this opportunity to present the opening address for the 2010 Race and Pedagogy National Conference. I don't think that there is much that I can offer that would come close to the words of wisdom, insight, experience, and courage that the Honorable Harry Belafonte would have offered had he been able to be here in person tonight. But I would be remiss if I did not begin by offering a tribute to Mr. Belafonte, whose physical absence cannot detract from his spiritual presence here this evening. His life is a lesson in race and pedagogy, in living and learning in a nation that has from its birth been struggling to be something better than it has been in the past, to embody the better angels of our natures, even as its worst characteristics of character have revealed themselves. We know him as an artist and an activist, a singer and a speaker, an actor and an agitator. He is, in the best and most classic sense of the word, a liberal educator, a man of stout heart and broad wisdom who has always inspired and inspirited the most important forms of education and knowledge, engaged education, and embodied knowledge. Indeed, were it not for his personal efforts, his professional achievements, and his political engagements, the rhetoric and politics of disintegration would have had far more devastating results than they have. Thus, even in his absence from the stage tonight, all of our lives have been enriched by his presence on the stage of history. And he was so very present. In 1961, he provided much-needed financial and moral support for the Freedom Riders, who risked beatings, bombings, and brutality just so they could sit on a bus together. Just so they could sit on a bus. In 1964, he traveled to Mississippi to support the students who went there to register voters, serve as teachers, as heroes in freedom schools, to build a political party and integrate that disintegrated culture that the esteemed Southern historian James Silver called the closed society. Mississippi, is this America? He was and continues to be a pivotal figure in the black freedom struggle, the movement that gave rise to the civil rights that many of us now enjoy, even as we watch our culture return to the disintegrated state of affairs from which activists like Chude Allen Parker, James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, Mary King, John Lewis, Jewel McDonald, Robert Paris Moses, Mickey and Rita Schwerner, and so many others tried so courageously and desperately to free this country. We cannot answer the question, what can we learn from here, without starting there? That moment of hope in which young women and men, both highly educated and horribly undereducated, both savvy in struggle and naive in knowledge, came together with one heart and many minds, and with wrenched souls, spirits, and psyches, wrestled with the angels of their own better natures. They wanted to make America make it right. And as Mr. Belafonte's good friend, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would demand, to be true to what you put on paper. The question, what can we learn from here, is of course a paraphrasing of and a signifying on the question that King asked late in his life. Where do we go from here? The alternatives he offered were prescient. Community or chaos? This, it seems, has always been our struggle in this nation. From the beginning, we have been torn between faith and reason, between Christianity and capitalism, between freedom and license. We have traded the tyranny of royalty for a tyranny of the majority, have witnessed the transformation of words about the common welfare turn into words that wound, have watched all of our rhetorical institutions, law, politics, education, and religion degenerate at times into rigid and dogmatic polemics, too often masquerading as dialogue, debate, discussion. We have seen political correctness demoted from a positive affirmation of the right to self-definition to a negative accusation of ideological self-interest. We have been nonviolent with those who have been violent with us, have loved the enemies that have and continue to engage in crimes of hate against us. We have been drum majors for justice while being rolled over by the unjust. What can we learn from here that we have not already learned from there? Perhaps that the closed society of the past has yet to truly open the American mind in the present. That the legacy of freedom riders and summers have been relegated to the back of the bus and grown cold with the advent of winter in America. That having been for a brief moment at the peak of the mountaintop of community, we have looked over only to find a chaotic abyss in which history is lost and voices of struggle echo faint and distant. Perhaps that race and all its attendant divisions of difference and identity is resistant to the emancipatory possibilities of pedagogy. I cannot imagine that anyone in this room wants to believe that, for it would doom us all to Sisyphean failure, place us between the rock that the builders rejected and the hard place of a history without meaning or memory. But what would it mean if it were true? If race were truly resistant to pedagogical persuasion, while such a statement might seem debilitating, perhaps it might also be liberating if we were to integrate it into our discussions and conversations during the next few days. Indeed, what would it mean to rethink our strategies, our commitments to dialogue, that symbolic parallel to nonviolence? What would it look like if we relinquished our investments in coherence and consilience, in Rogerian and invitational rhetorics, in reaching across the aisle only to have our hands slapped, or speaking truth only to be called liar in a public setting? What if the willingness to pursue a more perfect union cannot be taught by reason or example? What could we do? What would we do? Where can we go from there? Perhaps, as it is often said in communities of color and conscience, we will need to take one step back in order to, I hope, take two steps forward. We will need to revisit one silent story in that history of freedom riders and summers that few of us ever learned about against the backdrop of nonviolent resistance and beloved community. It is the story of Robert F. Williams. It is the story of Negroes with guns. Now, before anyone gets too excited, let me say explicitly that I am not advocating violence. I'm just telling a story. Not a story about violence, but about self-defense, that most basic of American rights, the right to form a well-regulated militia necessary to the security of a free state, the right to keep and bear arms, what could be more patriotic? And Robert F. Williams was a patriot. He served honorably in the United States Marine Corps and returned to his home in Monroe, North Carolina in 1955, where he encountered, as Gloria House tells the story, some of the most brutal forms of dehumanization. But Robert Williams redefined, he re-signed the response to that dehumanization with a new kind of sit-in, the kind in which self-defense was integrated with nonviolence. His own words explain the tangible results of his strategy. There was less violence in Monroe sit-ins than any other sit-ins in the South. In other communities, there were Negroes who had their skulls fractured, but not a single demonstrator was even spat upon during our sit-ins. We had less violence because we had shown the willingness and readiness to fight and defend ourselves. We didn't appear on the streets of Monroe as beggars depending upon the charity and generosity of white supremacists. We appeared as people with strength. And it was to the mutual advantage of all parties concerned that peaceful relations be maintained. Williams' willingness to defend himself and his community emboldened other black people in Monroe, so much so that when Mr. and Mrs. Bruce Stegall decided to ride through one neighborhood, a neighborhood where only one day before they had gone through with a sign that read, "Open Season on Coons" on their car, they were stopped and detained by an angry mob of residents. Williams intervened, shepherded the Stegalls to the safety of his own home, and then escorted them from the community. But the story of Robert Williams does not end there. Indeed, his act of generosity backfired. The Stegalls accused him of kidnapping, and the police and FBI went after him. Williams fled Monroe, first to Canada, and then to Cuba, and finally to China, where he remained until the late 1960s. He spent the last 27 years of his life in Baldwin, Michigan. Robert Williams passed away in 1996, and while few know of his life and legacy, the spirit of resistance that he embodied continues to live on in the memories of those who know the hidden history of the movement and those who remember and live to tell this story. The story of Robert Williams is not about violence or retribution, anger or hatred. It is a story of courage, of the exercise of inalienable rights, and of the willingness to defend those rights by any means necessary. Let me stress here again that I am not advocating violence, armed resistance, forming a militia, or any other such madness. What I am advocating is that we reconsider how we respond to the symbolic violence, those words that wound without conscience or consequence, that contribute still to the disintegration of the American dream and pathologize the American mind. I invoke pathology here not as a metaphor, but as a literal characterization of race, extending Ashley Montague's description of the term as man's greatest myth to what might seem more accurate, appropriate, and empirically verifiable. Race may well be our greatest madness. If so, then we must consider carefully the role of pedagogy for seeking its remedies. For if this is madness, it would be mad to believe that one can be educated out of it. As I have studied and reflected on race for 25 years and lived it for 25 more, I have tried to discern the different ways in which we attempt to explain how it has manifest itself in the behaviors of men and women. I have asked myself, how can it be that a nation founded on genocide and slavery could be imagined as free and just? How could it be that the framers of a declaration of independence from oppression and tyranny could depend on reason and faith to tyrannize and oppress as diverse a collection of cultures and peoples as those kidnapped from Africa and reduce them to a single identity, no, entity, called Negro? How could so many remain so silent and complicit in the violation of the spiritual and epistemological impulses of Western moral philosophy and ethical practice, embracing a social contract in the abstract while enacting a racial contract in reality? How could one explain to one's child, as Dr. King wondered in his letter from the Birmingham jail, why some people treat other people so badly? When the negativities characteristic of race have insinuated themselves into the realms of class, gender, sexual orientation, and myriad other realms of difference and identity, how can we explain why people do unto others as they would never wish to have done unto themselves? I've come up with three answers. To state it in the vernacular, in the language of the slave, it's because they're stupid, evil, or crazy. The first, the one that we have embraced for so long with an audacious hope, constructs race as a problem of education, or more accurately, miseducation. It allows for the possibility that we can be educated to see beyond skin color and achieve that space beyond race that W.E.B. Du Bois called transcaucasia. The second, which has been invoked most fervently in the early teachings of the Nation of Islam, as epitomized by the phrase invoked and then rejected by the late Malcolm X, that race is the work of the devil. The final understanding of race, and the one that seems to me to make the most sense, is that race is a social sickness which, because of its normative character, resists intellectual and moral intervention. This does not mean that it cannot be remedied through pedagogy per se, but it does demand that we rethink the problems and possibilities of pedagogy as we now understand, envision, and enact it. Pathologies require interventions different than those that we initiate in the classroom. They demand experiences that instruct the mind, the body, and the soul, that energize spiritually inspired militancy like that which emerged in 1964 in Mississippi in Freedom Summer. To remedy such pathologies might require a leap of faith in the work of words, one more defined by imagination than knowledge, a leap which one of the greatest teachers of our time, Albert Einstein, understood. And he also understood that race was a sickness. I cannot help but wonder what Mr. Belafonte, if he were here with us tonight, might say about this view. I think that he would like the story of Robert Williams, because Williams was as uncompromising in his commitment to self-expression, to self-defense, as Mr. Belafonte is to self-expression. When Mr. Belafonte was criticized for his very open opposition to the policies and practices of the administration of George W. Bush, he welcomed that criticism with the words, "Bring it on. Dissent is central to any democracy." Mr. Belafonte refused to resign the opposition, but re-signed it with a clear understanding of the nature of the language needed to demand the right of self-expression by every means necessary. He would invoke without hesitation words that defend against words that wound. He would defy the tyranny of the majority and uncompromisingly describe himself in these terms: Harry Belafonte, patriot. And what might he say as a patriot, as a teacher, as a hero, to those of us gathered here this evening who today enjoy the rights and privileges for which the students he supported so many years ago fought, and some died? In honor of this great artist, thinker, and scholar, I would conclude this tribute with his words, that we might reflect on his life and insights as we dialogue, debate, converse, and commune during these next few days, as we ask ourselves the question, what can we learn from here? I suspect that he would answer my question with one of his own. With the question that he asked at the 50th anniversary of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee held at Shaw University earlier this year, where is our voice? Why is it so soft? In honor of Mr. Belafonte, let us find in the next few days our voices and speak them loudly and passionately and with commitment against the rhetoric and politics of disintegration.